Hi there, Carolyn and Marco here.
Thank you for tuning into the world.
Before we get to the show, we wanted to quickly remind you that we have a fundraising drive happening right now until June 14th, and we could use your help to meet our goal of raising $25,000.
We've enjoyed hearing from some of you over the past few weeks with your kind words along with your financial support. Laurel wrote in to say, "The world is always the highlight of my day. Thank you for sharing stories that make me think, question, and pause."
I love that. Think, question, pause. Now we are asking you to be a little bit more like Laurel and support us at The World in whatever way you can. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make a donation.
That's theworld.org/give. It means so much to all of us. Thank you.
Hey there, I've got a quick favor to ask you. We are doing a listener survey to learn more about how you listen, what you like about our show, and maybe what we could improve on. It takes about 2 minutes to fill out, and we would be grateful if you did. You can find that survey at survey.prx.org/world. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you. Last week,
به دلیل علاقه که به هم داشتیم خیلی زود صمیمی شدیم.
I met Mehdi Hajati while he was in hiding, still reeling from the sudden death of his dear friend, Mohammad Shabani. When Mohammad was in Turkey, he began publicly revealing the regime's local secrets in Shiraz.
Just imagine receiving threats.
And he got messages that he believed were from the regime.
Day by day, things worsened.
A small number of people knew the facts of Mohammad's life at this time. Now, one of them was agreeing to talk to me. This is Lethal Dissent. There were people who might have been able to save Mohammed, but didn't.
And the person on the other end of the line didn't even want to speak to me or listen to me.
Mohammed's life as a dissident was already hard. It got harder. And then it ended. Episode 3, Losing Touch. I first found out about Mohammad Shabani's death from a longtime contact in Istanbul. They told me people were saying it was suspicious. I tried to piece together what happened using tweets and other social media posts. According to what I found online, Mohammad fell from the fourth floor of his apartment in Turkey. He landed in the street. There were supposedly cuts on his body, and he was wrapped in a blanket. He was taken to the hospital, where he went into a coma. 2 weeks later, he died. It was October 22, 2022. A month later, a friend of Mohammed's family in Shiraz posted on Instagram. He had talked with Mohammed's family. He wrote that a Turkish prosecutor told Mohammed's mother that Mohammed's death was being investigated as a murder. Apparently, the prosecutor found threatening messages on Mohammed's phone and a lot of blood in his apartment. That's what this friend posted on Instagram. He also wrote that Mohammed's mother told the prosecutor, "I don't care about your investigation. I just want to take my son's body home." This post is what got me talking to Mohammed's friend, Mehdi Hajati. He and Mohammed had worked together as civil servants in Shiraz, where they got on the wrong side of the local regime. I talked to Mehdi because I wanted to understand Mohammed's past and his life as a dissident in exile, because Mohammed wasn't the only Iranian to die while living abroad. Far from it. It hadn't taken long for Mehdi to hear about Mohammed's death. I asked him, "Who told you? How did you find out?" We had mutual friends in Iran and they messaged me. Then I went online and saw that a few of his friends had written about it. I was startled.
طرف رو گفتیم چرا شما اینجوری نوشتید؟ بعد توییتش رو پاک کرد.
Mehdi knew what it was like to be a dissident in exile. He fled from Iran to Turkey 3 years after Mohammed did. He knew how far the Iranian regime would go to intimidate and frighten their enemies abroad. Mehdi had been threatened too, even through Mohammed. Like the time Mohammed got a message on Telegram for Mehdi. Maybe your friend came to Turkey to be with you, your spy friend. He's more of a traitor than you are. You both have to seek refuge with your criminal master, Israel. And now everyone knows who you really are. Mohammed forwarded it to Mehdi. They're pretty sure it was from their prison interrogator because of the personal details. This is the same guy who interrogated both of them when they were locked up in Shiraz. And that guy was still sending them messages even after they fled Iran. The message also instructed Mohammed to tell Mehdi, the regime is coming after him, and he should sleep with his eyes open, even in the shower and even in the bathroom. Remind him to watch his back. As far as the Iranian regime was concerned, Mehdi and Mohammed were forever linked, even in exile. That meant Mohammed and Mehdi faced similar dangers.
و خیلی غم انگیز در یه تنهایی عجیب و غریبی محمد رو خاک کرد.
آخرین باری که با
I ask, the last time you spoke to him was when and about what?
اصلا یادم اینقدر سر من شلوغ بوده در این ماها.
He says, I was so preoccupied that I don't even remember. I just remember asking how he was and what are you up to. Mehdi says he was busy thinking about the uprisings against Mahsa Amini's death in Iran. She had been arrested by the morality police for not wearing her headscarf properly and died in custody. Mehdi was participating remotely, helping organize protests in Iran via social media. When he talked to Mohammed on the phone, Mohammed tried reminding him how important their friendship was to him.
عرض ارادت و احوال پرسی صمیمانه و دوستانه بوده که خوبی چیکار میکنی؟
Mehdi says, the last time I talked to Mohammed, I said I might go to Istanbul. He said, don't go without telling me. Tell me beforehand when you're going to go to Istanbul and I'll arrange it so that I can go too. I told him, okay, I'll let you know.
که من هم همزمان بیام اون چند روز استانبولی با هم باشیم. گفتم باشه من اومدنی شدم خبر.
But they would never meet in Istanbul. Instead, they lost touch. The time period between when Mohammed arrived in Turkey in the winter of 2018 and when he died 4 years later is important to understanding what might have happened to him. So I went looking for friends who stayed in closer contact.
My name is Vahid Davar. I'm an Iranian poet living in Scotland, and I'm near the end of my journey as a PhD student at the University of St. Andrews.
He and Mohammed met in the literary circles of Shiraz. They were close friends for more than 17 years.
And he became like a brother to me. He knew that I loved apple pies, and whenever he paid a visit, he brought me apple pies.
Together, Vahid and Mohammed endured the claustrophobia of being a writer in Iran.
In totalitarian regimes, literary creations can be deemed as subversive means. When a poet or a writer, a fiction writer, gives a different narrative about the events, about things that are taking place in the country, which is different from that of the regime, that's counted as a subversive act.
Vahid says that whenever he and Mohammed and their friends gathered as a literary group, whether in cafes or restaurants, the government would surveil them. They threatened to shut down the businesses. Eventually, the literary group decided to meet in the lobby of the Park Hotel in Shiraz. They thought in a bigger venue, they might be left alone. But even that didn't last. The manager of the hotel asked them to leave. Not long after, Vahid fled Iran and was granted asylum in the UK. Mohammed stayed, and then he was imprisoned. In September 2018, after Mohammed was accused of being an Israeli spy, Vahid couldn't stop thinking about him.
It was as if I was in prison myself. I had some of my darkest days during those days, not knowing what was going to happen to Mohammed, because I only knew the accusation. And I knew that a penalty for that would be the heaviest one.
Mohammed would later tell Vahid about how the regime had threatened him. They had even contacted his family while he was in jail.
They received threats via phone calls or text messages. They even threatened his family members in person.
Did he tell you what they would say to them? What kind of threats?
That he would be executed.
The threat of execution continued even after Mohammed was released from jail. He decided to make a run for it, smuggling himself out through the mountains between Iran and Turkey. It was winter, with temperatures around zero and rough terrain. Mohammed wasn't fit. He smoked and didn't exercise. He later wrote that at one point, he was vomiting blood into the snow because he was so weak. He barely made it to Turkey alive.
He sent me a message on my Instagram to say that he was ensconced in a shared house shared by asylum seekers in Istanbul.
Vahid says this was a huge relief. They started talking and texting.
We sent each other text messages from time to time when he had penned new poems, he would send them to me. We had phone calls, although they were sporadic.
Vahid was working on his graduate thesis at the time.
And I'm really sad. One thing that deeply saddens me about these years of doing this PhD, the 4 years I was less than a human being, I was a thesis writing machine.
But Vahid said when he did talk on the phone with Mohammed, they had lengthy conversations. And so when an agent from the regime contacted Mohammed, Vahid heard about it. The agent reached Mohammed by phone and asked to meet him in Istanbul.
He met someone there, and that person proposed that Mohammed could cooperate with them.
That he cooperate with the regime?
To work with them undercover as an asylum seeker, keeping fellow asylum seekers under surveillance, and basically working as their agent.
This sort of thing is not unusual. Several dissidents have told me that they were also approached to be spies, and sometimes they were told that their families in Iran would be harmed if they refuse. But Vahid says Mohammed did refuse. He stayed involved in anti-regime discussions online, and then he did something even bolder.
ایدئولوژی که نظام رنگ باخته و ما با یک گروه های مافیایی خیلی قدرتمند روبرویم که پوسته ایدئولوژیک دارن.
That's Mohammed in a TV interview with BBC Farsi in June 2019. مالی هست که به بهانه های ایدئولوژیک و سیاسی شما رو میکشونن به دادگاه های مختلف. In this interview, Mohammed doesn't hold back. He says in the provinces of Iran, the regime's religious ideology has faded. Now it's more about money. He says the regime arrested Mehdi Hajati and him because they were standing up to a dirty real estate scheme in Shiraz. In 2018, when Mohammed and Mehdi were still in Iran, they were deeply involved in local politics. Mehdi was on the Shiraz City Council, and Mohammed worked for him. They were both progressive, and they were both disliked by the regime. In his BBC Farsi interview, Mohammed claimed that the regime didn't arrest them because they thought they were Israeli spies. They arrested them because they were defending the ancient gardens and old neighborhoods of Shiraz. Mehdi and Mohammed were trying to stop members of the regime from bulldozing historic sites. They began demolishing the cultural and historical fabric of the city, turning part of that area into malls and hotels. Mohammed told the BBC that it was clear members of the local regime were making a lot of money from destroying the city. And then he went even further. He accused the regime of being bedfellows with organized crime. He said the secret about the money flowing into real estate development was that it was dirty money, the criminal proceeds of who knows what. Mohammed made all these claims on the record to BBC Farsi on TV. It was risky, one of the riskiest things he did in exile, and there were consequences.
things exacerbated after Mohammad gave that interview to the BBC Persian, or, for example, gave an interview to Iran Wire, I think.
Iran Wire is a news outlet based outside of Iran. It's critical of the regime and publishes in Farsi and English. Mohammad gave an interview to them on April 9, 2020.
So after those two interviews, he received more threats.
Can you tell me specifically what type of threats? What would they say in the threats?
We know where you live. They sometimes, gave him the address. And you are very close to us. We are very close to you. And we can do whatever we wish to you.
And the threats were mostly on the phone?
Yes. Yes, that was what Muhammad told me. Yeah.
Okay. But he kept talking about them with you. He kept telling you that these were the messages coming to him.
Yes. Quite regularly, almost whenever we spoke.
Mohammed told several friends that someone sent him an image on his phone that really scared him. It was a picture of his apartment building in Turkey. The pressure that the regime was heaping on Mohammed, all their attempts to scare him, it was working.
Just imagine receiving threats, okay? And you are in a country in which you have no rights as a human being. You are not a human being. You are not a human being. You are a hole, something that doesn't exist. A walking hole.
Vahid says Mohammed felt more and more alone in Turkey. And so he pushed him to try something new.
Mohammed, leave your flat. Go to the town. Instigate conversations with people, make acquaintances. You will find like-minded people. But he even didn't want to learn the Turkish language. He had lost all his hope. One of the saddest things that once he told me was that there was a corner shop in the area from which he bought his cigar. And one day when he went there, because he couldn't communicate with a shopkeeper, he needed to put things in Google Translation and get the translation in Turkish. And after the shopkeeper spoke nastily to him, Mohammed wrote something along the lines of, "Look, I used to be someone in my own country. Don't speak like that to me." And showed it to the shopkeeper. And the shopkeeper rejoined, "Yes, in your country," meaning, yeah, you used to be someone in your country, but you are nothing in this country.
Turkey hosts the largest number of refugees in the world, about 4.5 million people. And there's a fierce anti-immigrant sentiment throughout the country. Mohammed lived in a small town. Discrimination only isolated Mohammed more, and the strain wasn't just psychological.
I was sure that he even didn't have enough money, but he was too proud to speak about it. In literally every phone conversation that we had, I asked him, "Mohammed, can I send you some small amount, very small amount, and that's something a brother wants to give to his brother through Western Union. That's easy. Would you allow me to do that?" The answer was a fat no.
Still, Vahid kept trying.
But even when I asked, it doesn't need necessarily be money. "Mohammed, I would love to send you some presents. I don't know, it's winter. I would love to send you a jacket. Please send me your address." He never sent me his address. Never.
So Vahid tried to help Mohammed in other ways.
I encouraged Mohammed to correspond with foreign embassies and consulates in Turkey. And I myself drafted some emails for him. And I drafted the emails, I sent them to Mohammed, and I asked him to email them to various consulates, to more than, 10 consulates and embassies.
Mohammed followed Vahid's advice and sent the emails. He even wrote human rights organizations long-winded explanations about his struggle.
But unfortunately, all of them were met with silence.
Do you remember which ones?
The consulates that I drafted emails for were Germany, France, the UK, Switzerland, Canada.
What about the US?
The US as well. The US as well.
Vahid says Mohammed felt dejected. He was becoming more and more depressed. So Vahid suggested they try the United Nations.
I called the UNHCR in Geneva, in Switzerland, and the person on the other end of the line didn't even want to speak to me or listen to me. When I was explaining the situation, he kept saying that we have this website and you can send us your inquiry through this website. And I was trying to explain that I tried those websites to no avail because I live in the UK, but I'm trying to help somebody stranded in Turkey in a very dire situation, receiving threats from the agents of the Islamic Republic. And that person abruptly ended the phone conversation. He didn't want to speak to me.
Vahid says this was agonizing for Mohammed, not only because he was being ignored, but because he had to ask for help.
And even for drafting those letters, he apologized a million times. I embarrassed my friend. I'm so embarrassed. I'm ashamed, my friend. I'm a mess. You know, he kept repeating these things about himself.
Vahid says about 2 years after Mohammed arrived in Turkey, he tried to escape. In the winter of 2020, the Turkish president, in a dispute with Europe, openly encouraged refugees to flee to Greece. Mohammed was among the thousands of refugees who rushed to the border between Turkey and Greece, but he got stranded on a piece of land between the two countries. He eventually was able to return to Turkey with the help of a lawyer.
He was so hopeless about moving on and going to another country, and he didn't want to stay in Turkey anymore.
Yeah. And as time went by, how did his mental state get affected? Was he someone you would say is mentally ill?
No. He was not, you know, at least during the years we were friends, I didn't know him as somebody mentally ill. No. He was a cheerful soul. He was such a serene person. I never saw him speaking angrily, for example. So he had this mental equilibrium, if you like. But after he left, year by year, I would say day by day, things worsened.
Mm-hmm. Was he taking medication here? Did he have access to healthcare?
I don't know how regularly he had access to health care, because I don't know about the asylum system in Turkey, really. And I'm ashamed to say that I have needed to ask more about it.
Vahid says it was clear to him that it was becoming harder and harder for Mohammed to take care of his basic needs.
You know, one of the things he had issues with was sleeping. He couldn't sleep. And he several times told me that he was taking these pills to get a few hours of sleep. He was in a very shaky, fidgety mental state in the last months.
Vahid pauses before he speaks. He has salt and pepper hair, dark brown eyes, and soft features. It seems like this is all weighing on him. He says he worried about his friend, but he was also so busy writing his dissertation. And then one day, his phone pinged.
I received a text message on WhatsApp from a friend in Germany asking me what had happened to Mohammed. And I knew nothing. I was just shocked. And I replied to her, and she said, they say Mohammed is dead. And then immediately, my first reaction was calling Mohammed and sending him text messages in vain, and then reaching out to some people, some friends, mutual friends in my hometown, Shiraz, to ask if it was true. I went back to my office and I told my office mates I lost Mohammed and I couldn't stay. I went for an aimless walk in St. Andrews. When I speak about myself, I need to speak about myself, because these selves carry the imprints of the people we have loved in our lives. And sometimes I can I can acknowledge that my laughter is not my laughter. That's a loan from Muhammad. That was the way he laughed.
Vahid says Muhammad died alone, but his death was part of a larger pattern.
When we speak about this regime, we speak about a bunch of rowdies. And their first means of holding sway over people and exerting power is threat and violence. And Muhammad was not the first person who fell victim to this oppression machine. And as you mentioned, there have been several cases of people being assassinated in Iran and outside the country. So, yes, this is emblematic of the way they treat dissidents, and they have no shame about it.
I talked to more of Muhammad's friends abroad, and they confirmed Vahid's observations of Muhammad's character and mental health. But if I wanted to know what actually happened to him in Turkey, I had to go to where he lived and died. Lethal Descent is reported by me, Farih Banawa. Reporting in Turkey by Beril Eski. The series is produced by Chris Harlan Dunaway. Our editor is Ibi Caputo. Additional research by Omar Faruk. Fact-checking by Beril Eski and John Klopotowski. Özge Sebzeci is our photographer and multimedia producer. Artwork for the podcast by Hatia Geri. Mixing help from Jenna Gadbois. Musical score and sound design by Ozair Ahmed. Legal review by Eric Brass. This story would not be possible without support from the Pulitzer Center and Radio Zamana. Thank you to our partners, The Verge and PRX. Special thanks to executive producer for The World, Dan Lothian, and managing editor for The World, Tinku Ray. Also, our friend ER, Shahnam Gulsheni, Adnan Devrim, Hamish Brown, Jonah Heller, Levi Bridges, Kate Ellis, Stephen Smith, The JJs, Banu Azizian, Andisha Azizian, Jawad Hassanzadeh, Yitan Yujar, Rashad and Alan at Splice Media. And to the Iranians who helped us, whose full names we can't use for security reasons, thank you, HM, AM, and MB.
One last note before we go. We are grateful that we're the source of international news you rely on. We're able to focus our global reporting on the people at the center of these events because listeners like you support our work financially.
We are fast approaching the end of our fundraiser on June 14th, so if you've been meaning to donate but haven't quite gotten around to it yet, now is the time.
Consider, please, a monthly donation. They are especially helpful in supporting our work year-round and help us plan for a whole year of ambitious reporting. So before this slides down your to-do list, visit theworld.org/give to donate today.
Your gift will get us closer to our goal of raising $25,000. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give.
Thank you for being with The World.